Good afternoon, Miss Brown. This is George Coleman again speaking. I borrowed two recorders to tell you my story again, but both recorders just didn't work properly. The tape you sent me, I just couldn't work it out on the tapes. So went out and bought myself a new recorder. And anyways, I needed one myself, so no damage done there. So, Cassie, I'll try now to relive that fateful day of 1942. And since you sent me your letter and explained a few things to me, a few more things have come back to my mind, and I want to thank you very much for this. So, no, Cassie, without waiting, I'll try to give you my story. My name, Cassie, is George Leo Coleman. I was born on April 4th, 1912, in Cumberland, Rhode Island. I joined the Navy on August 15th, 1930, and I made it a career. I spent 22 years and 7 months in the Navy, retired on June 9th, 1953, and came out as a chief boatswain mate. On that fateful day of February 18th, 1942, I was sound asleep that morning when I was awakened by a heavy noise against the port side of the ship. I awakened and was stunned for maybe 5 to 15 seconds, not realizing what actually had happened. The men are now scrambling from their bunks and putting on their clothes and foul weather gear. I jumped from my bunk, and in my haste, I just put on my dungaree shirt, my dungaree trousers, socks and shoes. As I stood there by my bunk, I felt the ship quiver and shake under my feet, and then there was silence. Now I was wide awake. I immediately went topside, and as I came out on deck, I looked out and saw the dark outline of the cliff in front of me. I still did not know what had happened and stood there for a few minutes getting my bearings. I looked at the side of the cliff for maybe 2 to 3 minutes. Then I looked towards the bow. So I made my way to the bow of the ship and got as far as the bridge when I came to complete halt. By the look of the bow, I could see that it was wedged deep in the reef and very close to the cliff. I saw those waves coming in at an angle, and they were pounding and crashing down upon the bow, and the bow was being torn up. I remember that the bow was loaded with bombs at that time, but they were all defused. I then came back and made my way amidships. From there, I looked towards the stern and saw those waves coming in. They were from 15 to 20 feet high, and they would crash against the cliff and climb that cliff like a raging sea. They would climb to maybe 40 to 50 feet up the cliff, then come tumbling down in a great white foam and bang themselves against the side of the ship, and the waves would come that close, and the waves would come very close to the top of the railing. I was so dumbfounded, I still did not have my wits about me. I just stood there in amazement looking. The blank spaces that you had before were not important. It's the first time I talked on a tape, so I let the tape run and try and think of what I was saying, so disregard them. As I looked down in the water below me, I noticed there was a very deep gap under the ship where the waves would be sucked under the ship, and then the next instant there'd be nothing but a big foaming mass of white water coming in, coming again to meet the ship. I believe, Cassie, that the gap was amidship, and I believe there must have been crack underneath. For as the waves would come back from the cliff, they would foam amidships, and then all of a sudden they would be seen, they would seem to be sucked under the ship. So all I could figure maybe was that there was a crack under the ship and that the water would be sucked under in that location. Now, Cassie, the ship is coming alive. Men are topside. They're moving back and forth looking over the side, and they're all dumbfounded. As I stood there, I heard the word, "Man, the life rafts." Now, sailors come down from the port side and up from below and gather around the railing. And then I see one of the men go towards the life raft, and he said, let loose the life raft. So they let loose the life raft, and the life raft was lowered into that raging sea. We had a line attached to it, and then I saw three or four men come down with lines. Now, these lines were in niches about the ship. We always had our lines where we could grab them when we needed them. So they must have grabbed these lines from some niche within the ship. I saw them lower two lifelines over the side, and they went down into the water. Now, excuse me, they draw the life raft in close to the ship. And then I see the first three men go over the side, down the line, and get into the life raft. Then two more men go down, and they're about three-thirds of the way down, and the life raft now is drifted away from the side of the ship. So they plunge into the sea and make their way to the raft. They get on the raft and cling to it, but then before my very eyes, the raft overturns. I see my very good friend George Marks is hanging on to the life raft when it overturned. Now, all the men are in the water of these five men. Then I hear my friend George Marks call up to me and say, "George, in the name of God, don't come in." Other men now are going over the side, down the lifeline, sliding on the lifelines, easing themselves into the sea. Some go all the way down, some go halfway down and jump in. As I look, I see my friend George Marks and three other men completely drawn under the ship. The gap I was talking about before, they've caught in this gap and have sucked them under the ship. You asked me about George. George was a first-class bosun mate aboard that ship. And George Marks was about 30 to 33 years old, about 5'8" tall. He had dark hair, ruddy complexion, and very friendly. He had a smile for all who were around him, and he never refused to help his shipmates aboard the ship. He was well liked aboard that ship, and I never did get to have a conversation with him before he went over the side, because everything happened so fast. And then, as I looked down, I saw these men in the water, and they were struggling and trying to swim, but it was like in a torrent sea down there. They were just being tossed around. Then I noticed that they were being carried towards the bow of the ship. Instead of making for the beach, the current was taking them towards the bow. Then they commenced to disappear one by one. They were sucked under the ship. How long this went on, Cassie, I really don't know. But I saw them going down, and I saw them go under the ship. I can't say that I was nervous. I was more dumbfounded as I saw these men going over. And I suppose, being so early in the morning, that they really wasn't yet wide awake enough realize what they were doing. And they just went over that side, and how long they went over, I really don't know, but they went over that side. Well, Cassie, you asked me how I actually felt when I saw these men going over the side. I believe I was more stunned and bewildered to see what was happening and just couldn't believe what was going on. I don't know how long I was standing there by the lifeline looking down in that raging sea when I raised my eyes and looked towards the beach, and I saw one sailor making his way to the beach. And then he may have been about 12 to 15 feet from the beach. I saw him turn around, face the ship, give a hand salute, and I saw him go down. And this is the truth. I don't know if any other men saw this or not. Also, as the men were going over the side, I heard the captain call out from the bridge, "May God bless you," or "May God help you," or words to that effect. Now, everything is quiet. There was no more sound. There was no more voices from the sea. Everything is quiet. Well, Cassie, I'm still standing by the lifeline, and to put you straight, I did not have no lifeline on myself. When I was talking about the lifeline, I was talking about standing by the side of the ship. And I'm still looking down into that raging sea, and I know that these men did not last any more than 3 to 5 minutes in that surging sea below us. Now I can see no more faces. Everything, as I said before, has turned quiet. Then men commenced to make their way towards the bridge. I'm still standing by the lifeline myself. Now I look down, and I know I've lost my very good friend, George Marks. And then I have a fear that comes over me also. Not the fear of death, but the fear of my soul. Is my soul in a state of grace? I don't know. I call out for the Mother of God for help. I then turn to my Lord and my God. I confess my sins to the best of my knowledge and go through my past life. I make an act of contrition. I am still standing there maybe 3 to 5 minutes when I felt an inner peace come over me. I turned to go towards the bridge, but for some reason I make my way back to the stern of the ship and take a look in that area to see what I could see. I went back there, and as I rounded the stern, I saw a young sailor back there all by himself. Cassie, I never did know his name, but I know he was young, perhaps around 18, blonde and blue eyes. But I couldn't tell you no more about him because, as I said before, I was only aboard the ship about a year, and I knew some of the deck force, but not all of them. The engineering force, I did not know too many. The stern was high out of the water, and she was swaying back and forth as the waves pounded her in the stern. I approached him and said, "What are you doing back here? You better go forward." He told me, "I want to be alone for a while with my own thoughts." I said no more to him, but I stayed with him. So I looked out towards the sea, and I noticed there was a couple of ships laying out beyond the reefs, trying to assist us. I know they put a raft in the water, but it didn't do much good to try and get to us. So I looked closely at the waves and saw they were coming in now. And they were coming in long, long swells and hitting against the stern of the ship. And the stern of the ship would gently sway back and forth. There was no panic back there between the boy and I. We were just looking out and watching the two ships out there. I believe one was a tugboat, and the other one, I don't know what it was. But then as we were talking, we felt a shiver or quiver under our feet, and a crack appeared in front of us. Now that crack was just about midships of the third cargo hold when it cracked open. And the crack was between, as I said before, between 2.5 to 3 feet wide. Now you ask me how much space we had back there. We had maybe about 15 feet from the crack back to the stern of the ship. The ship is now listed to maybe 12 degrees on the stern towards port. And the deck was full of ice. The hatch itself was so slippery you couldn't sit on it. And if you try to walk, you will slip and fall because we're walking at an angle. So we're sitting back there. It seemed to me like on a vent. It was flat, and we could sit there and talk with each other and talk with each other. So as we sat there talking, I felt myself getting very cold. My feet were cold. My ears were cold. In fact, my whole body was cold. And I commenced to slap my hands together and tap my feet and move about the best I could in that one spot. And after about maybe 4 to 5 minutes, I did feel a warmth come over my body again. Well, Cassie, what the young sailor and I really talked about back there, I have about really forgotten all about it. I know we talked about being rescued and what was going to happen to us and so forth. But for the conversation, I really could not remember that far back of what I said. But I do know we were back there maybe an hour and a half. Neither one of us could make a move because the decks were so slippery where we were sitting or standing. I looked at the sea, and now I see that the tide has now receded. The waves are now coming in long drawn or swells. They are now about 12, 15 feet high, but like waves coming in on a beach. They are still pounding against the mountain, but not climbing so high. So as I look, I have no fear now, Cassie. So I told the sailor, look, we cannot survive back here. The day is dragging out, and nobody knows we're back here. We yelled and screamed. We can't do any more. Then I told him that I thought I would try and make the beach. He didn't say one word. He just looked at me. So I eased my way to the lifeline. I placed one leg over the lifeline to go in. When he spoke, he said, hey, boats, could I please have your cigarettes and matches? When you go in, they'll only get wet. I looked back at him. His face was deadly white. And I said to myself, if I go in, you'll be all alone. And if I go in, I'll be alone in the water. And would I make it to the beach? So I came back and said, I'll have a smoke with you. So we sat there and we were smoking. Excuse me. Well, Cassie, I'm still back on the stern with the boy. The reason we couldn't get down to the side of the ship, as I said before, she was listed to about 12 degrees, and if we tried to walk, we would slip. But back on the stern, when I told you I made my way to the stern to go over the side, that part of the ship was still high and more level. It still had not slanted toward port yet, so the footing back there in that 15 feet of space was pretty safe. We're about maybe 5 to 7 feet from the crack amidships of the cargo hold. And now we are smoking. So you'll ask me, how come they couldn't see us from the bridge? You explained that in your letter. But Cassie, I'll tell you the truth. I don't remember a gun back there. If there was, I guess I was so upset that I didn't pay no notice back there of what we had back there at the time. But I know that the bulkhead of the ship did block us from the view of the bridge. We did have a high bulkhead back there, and that blocked us from the view of the ship. And we could not ease our way down to the lifeline, because if we did, we would not have been able to get back up towards the cargo hatch. So I hope that will clear that spot up for you. So anyway, we maybe smoked 3 to 4 minutes when 3 or 4 men came down from the bridge, and they had a lifeline. Now what actually happened was they, being on the bridge, had seen me when I went back to the stand to go over the side. They saw me back there. Then they realized that there's somebody back on the stern, and they come back and they threw us the lifeline. I put the lifeline around the boy first. And this is true, Cassie. There was a pad eye about maybe 5 to 8 inches from that big crack. So we could put our left foot against that crack and have a steady foothold. So when the sailors counted three, the boy jumped and they pulled, and he cleared the space. The same thing happened to me. They put the lifeline about me. They counted three. When they said jump, I jumped, and they pulled, and I cleared that crack. So now we're making our way to the bridge. I come up on the bridge, and the bridge is very active. Now all the survivors that are left are on the bridge. We are all gathered up there. I don't know how many are on the bridge. I did not count, but I know that the bridge was jammed with sailors. Now, I'm on the bridge again, and I'm still jumping around now. I can jump up there now. I'm dancing, I'm jogging, I'm rubbing my ears, I'm rubbing my hands. I feel myself become very warm again. I tell the men to move about up there, to warm their hands, rub their ears, but it seemed like no one paid no attention to me, what I said. Now, talking about the Rosa, yes, you were right. It was not the Rosa who threw that line on the beach. Because I remember now that after I talked to Greenfield on the beach, he told me the story about the Rosa, of how he did fall down on his way to Newfoundland, that he just dropped in his tracks. I remember all this now, and it comes back to me. So as I'm on the bridge, we then get Lloyd and Jack Kramus and Calamos and Lloyd to go in the boat, and they're going to hit the beach. Well, We managed to get the boat in the water, and when it did hit the beach, I did see the commander land, jump from the whaleboat onto the rock. I actually saw that. And then I saw the whaleboat crash into the cove. And like I said before, I had saw them light a fire down there and get a fire going. Now, where Greenfield disappeared to, I don't know. And how DeRosa get up that cliff, I don't know. Because I didn't see him no more. But I know that Lloyd was down that cliff. And who was with them? I just don't know how many were left in that cove down there. Now, coming back to the bridge, I notice now that there are three men on the beach. I know one of them as Dupree. And you say that the commander threw the line under the beach. I believe that you are right, and I accept that, because I was confused. I admit that. But I know Dupree grabbed that line, and I know that he was pretty wet and pretty cold on that beach. And I also know that he could not function in this proper way. So I saw him take that earphone that landed on the beach and take that line within his hands and sit down, and I saw him pull that line like clapping his hands and bring that line into the beach. Then we attached to it a 21 thread line. He'd done the same thing again. He sat there and he pulled that line in by clapping his hands, and he got that line all the way on the beach. Then I saw him take that line, put it in his mouth, and I saw him go around a rock that was embedded deep within the beach. He made two trips around that rock and pulled it tight. Then he put the line around his own body and pulled that tight. And then it seemed to me like he again put that line within his mouth and leaned back against that rock. Well, Cassie, coming back to the whaleboat now, I did see Lloyd and Greenfield get in the motor whaleboat and go ashore. I don't remember the other men who went in the boat with them, but you told me in your letter, Lieutenant Garnes, Lawrence, DeRosa. We lowered the whaleboat down into the sea, and the waves come up and picked it up like a cork. How they broke loose from the falls without crashing into the ship, I really don't know. But I saw that boat lifted up on a large wave and cast forward clear of the ship. Then again it was picked up. Then again it was picked up and was cast into the cove. It crashed into the cove. I saw the men come out of the boat and on the beach. They were back there for maybe an hour or an hour and a half. How they started that fire that they had built, how they had dry matches, I'll never know. But using the boat as firewood and the gas from the boat, they did light a fire in that cove. How long they were there, I really don't know. So now, Cassie, we go back to the bridge again. So we now had the 21-inch thread across to the beach now. And DeRosa and Dupree has it around the rock. And he braced himself against the rock. We send the first man over. I don't know his name. He weighed about 90 pounds. And he went over. He hit the water. His feet get wet. Maybe around his thighs and hip. He gets slightly wet. Then we sent the second man over, who was Ensign Brown. He went over, he got slightly wet, and he made it. Then we sent three or four other men over, and they got slightly wet, and they made it. But then, as the other men came over on the breeches buoy, they would pick up that line as he neared the beach, and this way here, the men were not getting wet no more, but landing on the beach. And in your letter, as you said, that was a large plateau there towards the bow. It was a long, drawn-out reef. We could walk around that area, and we never had no trouble, and walked around, and it was closer to the bow, like you said, now that I recall that. And all the men were taken off that ship. I was about maybe the 45th one over on the breeches buoy when I hit the beach. So I'm still dry. I'm still not wet. Now going up the cliff, it was more of a slant, climbing from that low plateau up towards this cliff. Excuse me one moment, please. Cassie, I talked to Harold Brooks, and he told me that four or five men had worked away up on that ledge and had a line with them. And he tells me that they had rigged a line up along that cliff ledge to the area where the mountaineers lowered the lifeline down to us. Now, I recall that there was such a line there, and then again, I can't recall it. It seemed like I knew it was there, but then and I just can't remember it. But he told me they had made a safety line from the plateau up to the ledge and along the ledge of that cliff to the spot where the mountaineers had lowered the lifeline down to us. And I believe him because he was pretty dry himself. He wasn't one bit wet. He never did get wet. And he was all in his foul weather clothes, and so he had his senses about him, and he was pretty alert all the time. So he really knew what went on there. And then he also tells me that they had a horse on top of the mountain that was pulling the men up. Well, Cassie, I never did see no horse up there. I was the second man up. But he tells me they did have a horse up there hauling these men up over the cliff. So I had to believe him again, that part there, because I told you he was very alert, and he saw more than I saw. So now we're up on top of this ledge here, working our way up, when all the men had abandoned the ship, and only one man aboard now, which is the captain. And then the captain gets in the breeches buoy, cuts himself loose, and comes down that breeches buoy and hits the beach. Well, I'm telling you, Cassie, that man received a tremendous ovation. I was very proud of that captain, and Captain Turner was a man. He was very calm. He kept his cool. He did not get upset. He knew what he was doing, and I believe that every man in that ship's company loved him very dearly. So now, we're making our way up this ledge. And as I said before, I just can't recall just how wide it was. But I know that as we made our way up, this one boy slipped. He's gone over the side when one boy grabbed him and his hands locked under his jaws. He commits a slip. The second man grabbed him. He commits a slip. The third man grabbed him, he commenced to slip. The fourth man grabbed him. There must have been at least a 5 to 6 man chain there hanging on. How long that boy hung on to him, I really don't know. But his hands just gave way. They slipped. And the boy crashed down into the sea. I know that 2 or 3 more was washed from that cliff. I never saw that there. And I don't know what really happened when they were washed away. Now, the mountaineers up on top of the cliff, the line is down, and the first man is being hauled up. As I said before, Cassie, I'm standing back there now, and even though it's slippery, and you can't hold your feet, I still manage to rub my ears, rub my hands, and shuffle my feet. And by doing this, I keep myself active and warm. Oh, I'm alert, but I'm now pretty tired myself. So the officer whom you said was Ensign Brown saw me back there, and that's who that man back there was jumping around. They said that was Boats Coleman. So they said, pass him along. And as I said before, I don't remember that lifeline being along the edge of that cliff. But it must have been because a man passed me along there, and I come up to him, and he says, "How do you feel?" I told him I felt fine. I was alert. So I want you to go up and give the mountaineers a hand. So the lifeline was placed around me, and I went up that cliff, the second one. And I wasn't hurt. I had a few scratches, a couple of bruises, but the line was so tight around my chest that when I did reach the top, I was a little bit out of wind, but otherwise in perfect condition. Yeah, Cassie, we were on that larger reef jutting out to the bow of the ship. And as we eased our way up to the ledge, we had to form in one line because the higher we climbed, the ledge became narrow. So now we are in formation, but we are either one or maybe two. We're not standing side by side. We're standing more of an angle. Like one's before me, and I may have my elbow against his left side, and we are huddling very close together. We cannot group in a mass up there because the ledge is rather straight, but in some places, she would veer off at an angle. So as you walked along that cliff, you had to be very careful of your footing because that cliff was all ice. There was no place up there where you could walk on dry ground. It was frozen solid from the time we left the reef and worked our way up on that ledge. So we had to hang very close to the side of the cliff and keep away from the ledge. Like I said before, it seemed to me we had about maybe 5 feet of clearance up there. Now, it may have been a little bit wider. I really can't remember. It's been so long ago, Cassie, I just can't remember these things when I come right down to it. Now, darkness has commenced to set in, and the tide is now about halfway up and back in again. The waves again pounding against the cliff. We can hear the roar of the sea below us. Now, Cassie, I'm on top of the mountain. They took the line off me, and one of the men said to me, "You look healthy and strong. You come with me." I followed him to maybe 200 or 300 yards from the mountain. It could have been closer. And they had a bonfire going there. He told me, "Now you come back with me. I want you to take these men one by one, and lead them back to this fire. Don't let them go to the left or to the right, for there are spots in this mountain where there are snow drifts, and the men may walk into one of these crevices and disappear." So my job was to go down the mountainside where the mountain men were pulling the men up. As each man came up, he was passed along to me, and I would walk them back to the bonfire. I made about 15 trips up and back to do this when I myself commenced to get exhausted. I was amazed to see these mountain men standing about 5 to 10 feet from the edge of that mountain, and so sure were they pulling these men up, it really amazed me. How they kept their footing at the edge of that mountain, I really don't know, Cassie, but they were wonderful men, and they knew what they were doing, and they knew what they were about. There was no fear in these mountain men. They got as close as they could. By then, I was so tired and weak, I could hardly keep my feet. I came back to the bonfire and sat down for about 10 to 15 minutes. But I got back on my feet again and halfway down I noticed every man was following the tracks before them. I would yell to the men to come this way. They saw the bonfire. They saw the tracks. We are now gathered around this bonfire. We have one man laying there. He's a first-class sawkeeper. Excuse me. Okay, Cassie. We have this one man laying there. He's a sawkeeper first class, and I remember his first name was Paul. So you know his last name. I got Paul Enoch Pulver here, if that's the same one now. He is completely frozen now and is dying. So we grabbed him. A man grabbed him by each arm and each leg, and one grabbed his face. We worked on him from 15 to 30 minutes, and we brought him back to life. We had his legs going back and forth. We had his arms going up and back and forth. We rubbed his face. We rubbed his neck. We lifted him off the ground, laid him on the ground, and brought him back. Then we commenced to talk to each other, and three or four men we had to drag to their feet and make them walk around. Keep moving, keep moving. Don't sit down, don't lay down. Keep on your feet, keep on your feet. We kept those men on their feet. This went on all through the night long. Excuse. Well, Cassie, when I was on top of the cliff, I kept on thinking about those men down in the cove and wondering if they'd be rescued or not. But I thank God that they were rescued. And now, as I said before, we worked all through the night keeping these men on their feet. I never did sit down no more. I kept on moving. And now, it's getting towards dawn, it's getting light. And then we see that the men from the village are coming for us. It was around dawn that the men from the village came in with their horses and toboggans. Maybe the toboggans were at least 15 to 20 feet long, with one long plank on both sleds. And those who cannot walk or move are placed on the toboggans. The rest of the men are formed in groups, and we start out across the plain. I am still moving, and I'm still jumping. We start across the plain, and it's a long, long walk, but these mountain men will not let us slow down. They crack their whips, but never once do they touch us. But their whips swirled through the air. Hearing the crack of the whip kept us moving forward. But now my feet are ice cold. My body is still warm, but my feet are cold. We come to a small shack on the way in, and they serve us coffee. That coffee really tasted good. But then we keep going until we come to the village, and I am taken into a home, completely disrobed. I wish I knew who the people were. I would gladly thank them dearly right now. I don't know how long I was in that room. I passed out from sleep, but when I came to, I felt weak in my body, and the people were looking down at me. About 2 days later, we were sent to a base in Newfoundland. I was taken by a tugboat, the minesweeper Kite, and placed in the hospital. I do not know how much damage has been done to my body after what I went through, but I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, where I had weighed 168 pounds. My body was now bloated. What caused this, I don't know, but I was like a great balloon in the bed. My feet were cold. My whole body was cold. I recovered in about three weeks' time. We were sent home to Boston, Massachusetts, to the receiving station in Boston, Massachusetts. While I was there, I was given 30-day survival leave, and I went home. And I had gained from 168 pounds. Well, I had been 168 pounds. I now jumped to 190 pounds. What causes weight on me, I still do not know. But all I could figure out was being out in that cold weather all that time with no clothes on, and I had caught cold in my whole body. Let's go back a bit now. I don't know how long I was on the beach ashore when I was called to identify some of the sailors who were drowned. I was taken to this large barn and saw about 50 sailors laying there in death. Well, Cassie, we're on side two now, so we're still up in that barn. Excuse me, I still don't know the coxswain's name, but I did talk to Hal Brooks, and Hal does know his name, but every time I call Hal on the phone, he's either out on business or he's away from home, and I don't have much contact with him. But he did tell me that he would write you. Now, when he's going to send you his letter or his tape, I really don't know. And I hate to bother him too much. Well, Cassie, I'm coming to a close now, so we'll go back to the first-class storekeeper again. But I can say, Cassie, that these men aboard the Pollux, they showed no panic, there was no fear. They worked as a team, and everything they could do was to help each other, they did. They were all courageous men of the U.S. Navy, and I know that those boys who survived the wreck But I know that those boys and these sailors who did start to survive that wreck were thankful for those three men who did reach the beach and did rig that breeches buoy onto the beach and did save the rest of the shipmates. Now, about Paul, we brought him back to life on top of the mountain. He was very mad at us because we did bring him back to life. He told us in the hospital that he met some of his relatives, that only his fingers were maybe an inch or 2 inches away, and they kept on reaching for him, and he didn't want to come back. And he said he was mad at us because we brought him back to life. So I guess we know that when people do cross that great divide, they do meet their loved ones. I don't know, I don't have much to say now, but I do know that those men who abandoned ship didn't last from 3 to 5 minutes in that raging sea. And I mean those seas were raging between the ship and the cliff. It was so close and yet so far to safety. Now, Cassie, when I was aboard the USS Pollux, I just turned 30 years old. I was a second class bosun mate aboard the USS Pollux at that time. After my survivor's leave, I was transferred to the USS Tuscaloosa heavy cruiser, 8-inch guns. I participated in the invasion of North Africa, then Southern France, then Normandy, then Cherbourg, and then we was in Portsmouth, England, when we had to make a trip from Portsmouth to Spitsbergen, Norway. They've had survivors up there that was bombed, and we were sent to rescue them.
They took all the provisions off our ship, the records, the money, food, only what we needed to survive. We maybe had about 60 rounds of heavy shells, 8-inch shells, but we had plenty of 40-inch and 20-inch and 5-inch ammunition. I forget how many days it took to make that trip, but Cassie, on the way up, we had to go through the icebergs, and it was a cold, cold trip. We came up to Spitzbergen, and as we came close into the harbor, we sighted enemy subs. One was on the port, one was on the starboard. They say there was 4 subs. I really don't know, Cassie, but I know we had 4 destroyers in formation with us. And these destroyers made a 360-degree turn, and I know that 2 of those subs were sunk, and I believe the other 2 were also sunk. Why they could not attack, I don't know. Perhaps they were weary, worn out. Perhaps they were cold upon those subs. The subs never did submerge. They're coming at us on the surface. And I know we did get 2 of those subs. We did pick up the men. We made our way out from the channel. Let me go back first. We did make our way in, and we tried to lower our whaleboat into the water, but it was so cold, and that water was so cold, that the engines just couldn't overturn. So some of the Norwegians on the beach came out in a longboat, and they took our men in the longboat onto the beach, and our men took over the longboats, and this way we transported these men aboard the USS Tuscaloosa. Some were wounded, some were badly wounded. We had them down in the mess halls. We had the doctors there taking care of them, all we could do to take care of them. Leaving there, I remember one incident happened on the way out. At the time, it wasn't funny, but now think back to it, it was funny. I was in the after lookout. I was in charge of the after lookout, and we had a commander back there with us. Was making our way out when we received a contact. The contact showed 15 miles behind us closing in. So we sounded general quarters and manned at all battle stations. The contact came closer, came to 10 miles, then it closed into 5 miles, then it closed into 3 miles, and we kept on getting report. What do you see? What do you see? We could not see a thing. You could smell the powder from the powder magazines come up all through the ship. Everybody was on the alert, and everybody now had a close fear. The enemy, we could not see it. Finally, it closed in to 2 miles, 1 mile, then past us. We never did see the enemy. Then later on, we found out that it was the coal from the coal mines that was being carried through the air with that northern wind and was picking up the slight coals, the slight mist that was coming through the air. We had contact with this, and it kept on closing in, but we never did see no enemy ships. It was this here coal that was being blown through the air. Well, Cassie, now our ship is being deployed, the USS Tuscaloosa is now being deployed to the South Pacific. We go in to the South Pacific and we engage in battle in Iwo Jima and Okinawa. Both these battles were terrific battles. Not a one-day stand, but a 3-week stand. Firing, bombing, and fighting day in and day out. Okinawa was the same way. We stood out there in Okinawa and watched the bombers come over and bomb that island. We heard over our intercom how the Japanese and the American forces to miss a move forward, to meet each other in hand-to-hand combat. We couldn't see nothing. All we could hear was a roar of the guns coming from the beaches. And it was a long, drawn-out battle on that one there. And then, another time, we was at sea cruising along in the South Pacific. Just what area it was in, I forget now. But we were cruising, and we were maneuvering back and forth, going to the left, going to the right, to miss mines and so forth, when we did run into a minefield. And these mines were attached to a long cable, and through the grace of God, we hit the middle of the cable. We did not hit the mine. But the bow was against the cable and brought the mines to the surface. We could see these mines as they floated in towards the ship. The boy on the lookout up in the crow's nest had seen the mines before the bridge could see them. And he called down saying, "Mines dead ahead." And the bridge reversed engines, but the bow did touch the cable. Then the boy on the up in the crow's nest would call down and say, "Give a right rudder, give a left rudder, back right, back left." And by doing this, he had a better view than we did. We backed away from this minefield and we did clear it. Now, it's the last day of the war, August 15th, 1945. And Cassie, I wish I could remember the boy's name, but I just can't. We received the word, ceasefire. The war's over. We had one shell left within the 5-inch mount under the starboard bridge. When they fired the 5-inch gun, it exploded, went up to the bridge, and the bugler was sounding ceasefire when that bridge torn up struck him, and his right leg was taken off. And that was a sorry moment in our life also. To see this boy sound the word ceasefire, then see him laying there with his leg taken off. Then we came back to San Francisco. And men received word they could leave the ship with points and go home. I was all for it. I went ashore that afternoon and met a friend of mine on the beach. He was in his blues, second-class petty officer. I forget his name, too, now. But he asked me if I could buy him some chow. I said, "What's the matter, broke?" He said, "Broke." I said, "I haven't had no pay now in 3 months. And I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I left ship on points. And I was supposed to go home east." He said, "But so many men are going east, they just can't get them back there." He said, "George," he said, "don't leave your ship, stay aboard as long as you can." He said, "There's no place to go over here." He said, "You're broke, the barracks are filled, there's no place to go." He was getting $5 every 2 weeks to buy the toothpaste supplies and so forth, but the pay accounts were closed up. So I went back aboard ship, and all the shipmates I knew aboard that ship, those who could leave on points left, but I stayed aboard, not knowing that I would again have to make a trip out to the South Pacific. So we left San Francisco, went out into the South Pacific again. Excuse me till I think these names over. So, Cassie, we went out to New Caledonia, and we picked up about 300 to 400 Marines off those islands out there. We left there and proceeded back to Honolulu. We came into Honolulu, and we picked up about 1,300 Marines from that island. And then we started a homeward journey again to San Francisco. At that time, I was the chief mess of arms aboard the ship. I was also the only chief boatswain mate left aboard the ship. So I had the ship and the chief mess of arms job. So in the morning, when we had to call muster and have all the Marines up for muster to call their names, the master sergeant told me, he said, "Chief, please don't call these men by name. Call them by number. We will be responsible for each man aboard this ship, but please don't call no name out." So we'd hold muster in the morning, and all the master sergeants and the major, the captain, would be up there with us. We'd call these men, we'd call them by number, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth, and they would answer. So after the muster was over, I went down to the chief petty officer squadron with the master sergeants. I asked him why we could not call by name. He said, "My friend," he said, "these men have been in battle. When you call the name McCormick, or you call the name Murphy, or Quinn, or Donahoe, these men were lost in battle, and they were their friends. If you call their names, they would start screaming and yelling. So we didn't call by name, we just called by numbers." We then pulled into San Francisco, and we discharged the Marines. Then we left for the East Coast, came through the Panama Canal, tied up in the port of Philadelphia. I had the first line over on the dock and landed. I had the first line over on the dock when the captain passed the word, "Chief Coleman, report to the bridge." So I said, "What in the hell have I done now to myself?" So I went up to the bridge, and the captain greeted me and said, "Chief, here's a letter for you. I want you to take it. I want to thank you very much for all you've done and for staying aboard this ship. I said, thank you, Captain." I went down below to the chief's quarters, opened up the letter, and he had wired in to Washington and had given me 3 years leave. 3 years shore leave, and I was transferred to Camp Perry, Virginia. And I went down to Camp Perry, Virginia, and stayed down there for 6 months. Doctor called me and examined me and told me that I was not to have no duties whatsoever, that I was to relax and take it easy. So my time was spent, Cassie, at the CPO club. I go down at 9 o'clock in the morning at the CPO club, and I would go swimming. I'd go bowling in the evening. I'd go to dances at night. And the doctor told me I was just completely worn out. Well, you see, Cassie, I was in the North Atlantic from 1937 under the war discharge in 1941. So, mother said I was at war from 1937 in the North Atlantic, patrolling the submarines and so forth. So I did have a busy schedule from 1937 to 1945, and I was pretty exhausted. So, Cassie, I guess that will close up my story, and I hope that this here tape will be a pleasure to you to listen to, and I hope in some way and somehow I've helped you with your book. So now I'm going to ask you a favor. Cassie, the old man now, will be 65 years old on April 4th, 1977. The years have just passed by. But Cassie, they've been happy years. I've enjoyed my life. I was married the first time to a wonderful woman. Her name was Helen Kosmicheski. Married to her for 25 years, and she died of cancer. I took care of her for 2 years and never did desert her. Stayed with her, took care of her, and the day she died. And through the grace of God, I met another woman. Name is Marcelina. Beautiful woman, redhead. Last name was Larson. And we married. In October 26, 1966, and I've had 10 years of another wonderful marriage. She's been a wonderful wife and a wonderful pal. But now my years are slowing by, and I want to ask you this question: could you send me one of your novels that you have written? So I may read it, and I will pay you for it. I don't want it as a gift. I'll gladly pay you for this book. For I don't know when you'll get this here story of the USS Pollux out, and I would like to read one of your books. So I'd appreciate it very much if you do this favor for me. And one more favor. Could you give me the location where I was taken to in Newfoundland, and could you give me a name of a Catholic church in that area so that I could drop them a token and have a mass said for those people of that town who, in the time of danger and the time of necessity, did go out of their way to help people who are in trouble. I'd appreciate this very much. And now I will close and say thank you and glad I could talk to you. May God bless you and may help you in your work. And may God bless your family also. George Coleman, yours truly.